From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, Secretary of State John Kerry announces a preliminary peace plan for de-escalating the crisis gripping Ukraine.
No more incidents of this kind should occur, and if they do, it will be clear that it will elicit a response.
Also today, whistleblower Edward Snowden joins Vladimir Putin's marathon Q&A session. We talk to a salvage expert about the ongoing rescue efforts surrounding the South Korean ferry disaster and the ongoing search for over 100 Nigerian schoolgirls abducted by Islamist extremists.
It affects many families, but it is something that I think as a world we have to address this question of terrorism and violence against women.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. High-level crisis talks in Geneva between Russia, the U.S., Ukraine, and the EU resulted in the four sides calling on Russian loyalists in the east of Ukraine to disarm. Clashes between Ukrainian government forces and pro-Russian separatists have recently intensified, leading to a number of deaths and the seizure of administrative buildings. Russian President Vladimir Putin's remarked that he has a right to intervene to protect Russian speakers in Ukraine, but Western leaders have called on Russia to step in to stop the illegal armed movements. Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says Russia has no intention of invading Ukraine and has offered amnesty to demonstrators being forced to leave Ukrainian administrative buildings. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry warned that Russia would face consequences if no immediate steps are taken.
We fully expect the Russians, as they said they would here today, to demonstrate their seriousness by insisting that pro-Russian separatists who they've been supporting lay down their arms, leave the buildings, and pursue their political objectives through the constitutional processes that the agreement guarantees. No more incidents of this kind should occur.
Earlier, in his annual televised question and answer session, Russian President Vladimir Putin says the country's parliament has authorized him to use military force in eastern Ukraine, but he said he hoped it would not be necessary. The session went on for 4 hours and included questions from Crimea Sevastopol, as well as from fugitive National Security Agency leaker Edward Snowden. Anya Ardaeva reports from Moscow.
He called the eastern part of the country a new Russia, saying it was transferred to Ukraine in 1920, adding that he was authorized to use force to protect ethnic Russians in the region. Former U.S. government contractor Edward Snowden, appearing in a pre-recorded message from a location that was not identified, asked Vladimir Putin about Russia's use of electronic surveillance. The Russian president said intelligence efforts in Russia were regulated by law, but that Russia did use the surveillance to track terrorist threats.
About 280 people remain missing after a South Korean ferry capsized and sank. Harsh weather is hampering search and rescue efforts, but at least 179 people have been saved. At least 18 are dead and many more injured. Most of the passengers on board the ferry were teenagers on a school trip. The cause of the accident is not yet known. The U.S. is aiding in the search effort. U.S. Navy Lieutenant Arlo Abramson spoke to NBC of the challenges involved.
The area where this occurred is the area of high traffic, and the weather of today was not very good. So it is a very difficult area. But again, our forces are trained for search and rescue.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. The state prosecutor in the murder trial of South African Paralympic athlete Oscar Pistorius has questioned the credibility of the forensic expert called by the athlete's defense team. Gary Nell told the court that the forensic expert had fabricated some evidence and ignored findings by the state's pathologist. Mr. Pistorius is accused of intentionally shooting and killing his girlfriend Reva Steenkamp. People retiring in the UK could soon be given an estimate of how long they have left to live by the British government. The Minister for Pensions says the measure may be introduced because people are underestimating the amount of savings required for their remaining years. UK correspondent Dan Whitehead reports.
The estimates of life expectancy will be based on factors such as gender, where someone lives, and whether or not they smoke. The Pensions Minister, Steve Webb, believes that providing people with a likely amount of time they have left will help them plan their finances better. He says the consultations would likely be paid for by the pension scheme companies, and discussions of life expectancy would be handled sensitively.
Prosecutors in the state of New York have told a jury that radical Muslim preacher Abu Hamza supported terrorism around the world. But Hamza's defense attorney says his client never targeted Americans. From New York, here's Rebecca Bowring.
In his opening statement, the prosecutor said the Egyptian cleric being tried under the name Mustafa Kamel Mustafa had been engaged in a global campaign to spread terror. He's accused of trying to set up an Al-Qaeda training camp in Oregon and of helping fighters attend a camp in Afghanistan, as well as providing satellite communications to kidnappers in Yemen in a 1998 attack that killed four people. Mustafa's defense lawyers said the cleric had never harmed Americans and will tell his story when he testifies, though he warned the jury they may not agree with some of his opinions.
And that's the latest feature story news. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. Secretary of State John Kerry announced a preliminary peace plan for de-escalating the crisis gripping Ukraine.
We fully expect the Russians, as they said they would here today, to demonstrate their seriousness by insisting that pro-Russian separatists who they've been supporting lay down their arms, leave the buildings, and pursue their political objectives through the constitutional processes that the agreement guarantees.
After over 6 hours of talks, the US, EU, Ukraine and Russia agreed to disarm illegal armed groups and return all illegally seized buildings to the rightful owners, referring to the recent takeover of sites in Ukraine by pro-Russian protesters. However, Mr. Kerry warned that Moscow's failure to match words with actions could result in deeper sanctions. Mr. Kerry also condemned anti-Semitic behaviour in eastern Ukraine, after reports said Jews in the city of Donetsk were told to register themselves as Jewish with a regional authority. For more on the potential solution offered by these four-party talks, I spoke to Christian Science Monitor's Sabra Ayres in Kiev.
Well, it certainly sounds that way on paper, but you know, it's a matter of what happens next and if the parties involved here on the ground in Ukraine agree to the conditions that were set out.
And what were those conditions?
Well, it sounds like what they're asking them to, the various groups across the country, to release the buildings that they've captured. This particularly applies to those in the east, and to lay down their arms. And I would assume that that would also apply to the sort of the groups that have been on the other side of the fence, such as Right Sector and some other groups that have said that they also have arms, and for to de-escalate the situation. So if those conditions are met, then that certainly would be a big start to progress here.
And there was also this offer, wasn't there, of amnesty to pro-Russian supporters, something that Kiev had already suggested earlier.
That's right. That's right. The Kiev has said that. He's been saying that for a couple of days now, and that hasn't, you know, attracted them to come out of the buildings yet and to release them. So I don't know if I guess we'll have to wait and see if this will have any effect.
And can you just remind us the issue of autonomy in that eastern region? Why is that so pivotal to these talks?
Well, the eastern regions, the separatists are calling for, well, those who aren't actually asking to separate from Ukraine are asking for more autonomy, and that would, it's unclear exactly what that would be, but we presume that would be they would be allowed to elect their own governors and their own local administrations, and also keep some control over their revenues or their tax revenues, essentially.
Right. So, but it sounds like there will be some conversation had over constitutional reform in Ukraine.
That's right. And this has been a big topic. The parliament today discussed it, and the prime minister is saying that they are willing to talk more about giving more sort of regional powers to across Ukraine, which would certainly change the dynamics and be a big step forward, I think, for the country.
And what do we make of these reports that Kerry referred to regarding the Jewish community in Ukraine? What can you tell us about that?
That is something that we have heard about. I've seen some stuff posted up on Facebook. Apparently there was a letter given to some of the Jewish community in, I believe it is in Donetsk, and asking them to sort of kind of register themselves as Jewish nationals.
Sabre Ayres in Kiev. And it was Ukraine that unsurprisingly dominated Russian President Vladimir Putin's annual question and answer session Thursday. The marathon four-hour phone-in covered a number of topics from the annexation of Alaska to the appearance of fugitive whistleblower Edward Snowden. To discuss the event, I spoke to Lilia Shvetsova from the Moscow Carnegie Center in the Russian capital.
You know, we are listening to this shrink session annually. And apparently our president enjoys it. I'm not quite sure about the participants. Every time Putin wants to seduce the country once again. And the fact that he talked to the nation in this way only reflects the nature of his power. If we had independent institutions and free media, who will need the president for 4 hours talking and solving our problems? But this session, Kevin, has been really special. Because this time, Putin has been addressing the nation and, in fact, trying to persuade the nation that it's the best way to develop further would be for Russia to be a great power at war. And he would like to be the war president.
But this comes just after John Kerry met with his counterpart Sergei Lavrov in Geneva and the Ukrainian representatives there. And if you listen to what was said, that seemed like a positive diplomatic meeting, perhaps even one step towards resolving the crisis. But Putin's narrative, you're telling us, in that Q&A was different?
He tried to be a bit complacent. He tried to be calm. He tried to be even nice and smiling. But, you know, his doctrine, the doctrine that he presented to Russia, and he was addressing Russia, he wasn't, you know, presenting his picture to the world. His doctrine was a doctrine of Russia as a unique state civilization, responsible for the world, responsible for Ukraine, and himself knowing much better what is useful for Ukraine. So he wanted to persuade Russians that they are responsible and accountable for the, Ukrainian nation. Isn't it interesting?
Putin denied that the Russian military were directly involved in what's happening in eastern Ukraine at the moment, but he did admit to their involvement in the annexation of Crimea.
Yes, he did admit it, but previously he had insisted that the camouflaged masked gunmen that took over Crimea were simply a local self-defense force. And if he lied once, where's the guarantee that he wasn't lying today?
He cut a very relaxed figure, although I don't think I've ever seen him cut anything other than that. Laid back, waiting for these questions. It was almost as if he knew what was coming. And that brings me on to Edward Snowden, the fugitive whistleblower wanted by the United States government enjoying temporary asylum in Russia. Tell us about what happened there.
Well, you know, Snowden looked like a prepaid, you know, piano in the bushes. Well, suddenly out of the blue. And emergence of Snowden only reconfirmed that there was a script, you know, something of that. And Snowden is the guy who definitely, you know, has to prove Russians that, something is pretty wrong with the United States and the West. Snowden as a victim, of course. And there were quite a few other unexpected, quote-unquote, personalities in the bushes, too.
Let's go back to Ukraine, Lily, if we can. And you talk about Putin wanting to be a war president. Can you tell us a bit more about that theory?
Well, in fact, the new Putin's doctrine means that Russia has to defend Russian-speaking population outside of Russia. And there's Russian-speaking population in Ukraine, in Belarus, in Kazakhstan, and in some other new independent states, including the Baltic states, now members of NATO and of the European Union. And another thing, Putin declares that Russia has to contain the demoralized West. You folks are living in a very demoralized countries, so we have to contain you. We have to deter our people from you. from your filthy, you know, absolutely, you know, negative principles. Besides, Russia has to be the pillar of the new galaxy, of the new universe. And universe, as always, well, has to have some satellites on its orbit. And Ukraine has to be one of these satellites.
Lilia Shevtsova from the Moscow Carnegie Center in the Russian capital. This is FSN Reports. Nearly 300 passengers remain missing in the ferry disaster off the coast of South Korea. 20 people have now been confirmed dead. Rescuers believe there could be some survivors trapped in the ship. Officials say 179 people have been rescued. The majority of the passengers were teenagers attending a school field trip. South Korea's Coast Guard is also questioning the ship's captain regarding the course taken by the ferry before it capsized. Earlier, I discussed the disaster with Captain John Noble, an international marine salvage consultant, and began by asking him about the chances of more survivors being found.
I think the government is quite right not to give up hope, because there is a remote, and I do say remote, possibility that somebody might be found alive in an air pocket, and that would be a miracle. Realistically, I think there's very little chance of anyone being found alive.
Earlier reports that oxygen was actually being passed through the vessel. Can you explain what they're trying to achieve with that and how that's actually done?
Well, I've never heard of this before, but essentially, and there are instances of air pockets in smaller ships, certainly, where people have survived for a number of days, even in warmer water. And one of the things that's very clear, that the oxygen in the air is very limited. Right. If they, and that's what eventually leads to the demise of people trapped in air pockets who are not rescued. But so by pumping oxygen into the ship, they are hoping that it will find the same space as the air. It will find its way through and help anyone who might be in there survive. I mean, it's a desperate measure, but it's one made with good and honourable intent.
We saw images earlier of men, we assume rescue workers in dive suits, physically hammering on the hull of that stricken vessel. Is it as simple as trying to elicit some kind of response?
Yes, I saw the pictures of these guys with hammers pounding away. Now, metal will resonate in terms when you hammer it. I think that it's a twofold exercise. One is to, if there is anyone in an air pocket, it lets them know that things are happening. Mm-hmm. And also it might encourage anybody who is still alive trapped in the hull to try and hammer out. Now, it's a sort of action which, again, as I say, is highly honourable. But the reality is that there might be no one there to hammer back.
Right. In terms of the depth that the ship is actually in, the depth of the waters, it's not considerably deep, is it?
But no, it's not deep at all by diving standards, certainly.
Right. What about the challenges, though, that the conditions?
Considerable challenges. I know that area of old, and there's quite a strong tidal flow round the Korean coast, and that would also apply offshore. Mm-hmm. And divers are only able to swim in the open water, or any water, in a very low current. And this is one of the issues here, that the current is too strong for the divers unaided to dive. Mm-hmm. That is then combined with the very poor visibility that they're reporting in the area. Now, visibility underwater can be very clear, as many people will know. But equally, when the mud is stirred up, it can be almost zero.
Mm. We have now, I think, nearly 200 passengers actually rescued.
Yes.
And almost 300 unaccounted for. Many of them teenagers, as we know. It's a desperate time for those families affected. The divers obviously will be scouring that vessel. This can't be an easy task for them either.
It is a dreadful task for them. I do recall after the Herald of Free Enterprise speaking to divers who were involved in the similar operation there, and it is very harrowing for the divers because they just have to get on with it in bad enough conditions, but finding bodies in those circumstances is truly harrowing.
International Marine Salvage Consultant Captain John Noble. Now, the fate of dozens of schoolgirls abducted by armed militia in Nigeria's restive northeast region this week remains unknown. That's according to the school's principal, who denied military reports which said the pupils had been freed on Thursday. According to police, the school in Chibok was overrun by suspected Boko Haram Islamists, another incident in the country's growing extremist unrest. Muna Ndulo, a former legal advisor to the UN and director of Cornell University's Institute for African Development, says the international community has to intervene.
Well, I think that is very tragic and is very shocking that this has taken place. It affects many families, but it is something that I think as a world we have to address this question of terrorism and violence against women.
In what way are the Nigerian authorities failing in addressing this violence? Because We're up to a death toll of some 1,500 at the moment. Don't the local authorities have to take responsibility before the international community steps in?
I think that both the local authorities and the international community have to take responsibility, in the sense that what we know of terrorism is that it's, of course, it's an international phenomenon, and that no one country can deal with it on its own. So Nigeria definitely has a responsibility to provide security. It has a responsibility to guarantee that its people are enjoying the human rights, and that there is freedom of movement and there's liberty within the country. But the terrorists are, of course, being financed by groups that are sometimes outside a given state. I think that the international community has to address those questions of, who is financing the terrorists, and in what way can we make sure that there is no impunity for this kind of behavior by groups.
Well, who is financing these Islamist extremists?
I think that is very difficult to know. I mean, it's something that, of course, I think the international community can and should investigate. I mean, we have faced this problem increasingly, but clearly somebody is providing the finances for this. So somebody has to provide the training. It has to do with the provision of guns. They have access to guns to do this. So I think this has had to be a multifaceted approach to how you deal with the issue.
Mr. Ndulo, why are young schoolgirls being targeted in Nigeria?
I think that it's not surprising that, you know, when you look at most conflicts in the world, women always bear the brunt of the conflict. They are often targeted. If you look at whether you are looking at the genocide in Rwanda, you look at, the conflicts in the Congo, it's always the case that women are targeted. And that's because society has really not, go to a level where it accepts the equality and, accepts that women have the same rights as men. And they're often a weapon of war in most of these situations.
You say that violence against women, you describe it as problematic as 20th century apartheid. Can you expand a bit more on that for us?
In the last century, we got rid of colonialism, we got rid of apartheid. And I think we should dedicate ourselves to getting rid of violence against women in this century and ending inequality. The only way we're going to end this is really accepting that men and women are equal and
but
ensuring
that's going to be a very tough mountain to scale in some states in Africa, isn't it, where that's not the case, certainly the more conservative states.
I think that it's not just one particular region. I think this is a worldwide phenomenon. I think that the one thing I think that I think one learns that, you know, patriarchy is a universal norm. I mean, you know, men have always dominated women historically. And I think that some societies have made much more progress than others. But I think that we need to work as an international community to take measures which ensure that these practices end. Mm-hmm. And this will involve building capacity for women, access to education, ensuring that they have access to economic power, because in the end, it's the differentials in economic powers that are really determining what's going on.
Muna Ndulo.
And finally tonight, having a bad hair day? The question printed below a giant poster of North Korea's Kim Jong-un that's the unlikely subject of a potential diplomatic row. The image depicting a smiling and saluting national leader was placed in the window of a hairdresser's in West London. However, the owner's attempts to pull in customers at the expense of the dear leader's own distinctive hairstyle quickly drew the attention of disgruntled North Korean embassy officials, who reportedly demanded the offending item be removed. FSN's London correspondent Dan Whitehead spoke to me earlier.
The M&M Hair Academy, which is in an area of South Ealing in West London, has been very much in the spotlight. Earlier this week, its owner, Mona Bash, put up a poster in his window to try and drum up some spring trade, with offering a 15% discount. But the poster in question had a very large photo of Kim Jong-un on it saying, "Bad hair day, come in and get your 15% off." That's all very well, but then he spotted two men just 2 days later after putting the poster up start to come and take photographs and make notes outside the shop window of this poster. They were dressed in suits, looked very formal, and he then approached them, and they came into the salon and said that they must take down this poster, saying it is disrespectful to the leader of the DPRK, insisting that it is removed quickly. Now, the owner, Mona Bash, said that he wasn't going to do this. He'd have to get lawyers involved if they wanted that to happen. So this has all come out of the blue, and what we have seen in the last 24 hours or so is the Metropolitan Police confirming that the embassy of the DPRK, which is happens to be a 10-minute stroll from this hairdresser's, has contacted the Metropolitan Police. The police have also spoken to the salon owners. No criminal offences appear to have been made, but it does look like the poster has now been taken down.
So did you head off yourself to visit this hairdresser in South Ealing, and did you get any response from the guy who runs the place?
Yep, I spent the day there today, and I was joined when I arrived by crews from around the world, Japan and other parts of Asia, TV crews all wanting to get a word with this owner. The shop, though, was shut. In fact, we saw a message from the shop owner's son on Twitter saying that he had closed for the day due to the huge press attention. He has given a few radio interviews in the last couple of days about the situation, but we were faced by a closed door. In fact, the Twitter message was in reply to a customer who booked an early morning hair appointment and was wondering why it had all been shut up. I spoke to the shop next door, which happens to be another hairdresser, who said that the North Koreans, in his words, had embarrassed themselves and that they should have just let this go and realised that it was just a bit of fun. Now, we walked 10 minutes around the corner to the DPRK embassy, and I spent 10 to 15 minutes pressing the buzzer. I could see curtains twitching, but no one came out to speak to us. The only comment is no comment from the DPRK embassy. But we do know that this has been a bit of a diplomatic spat, the Metropolitan Police confirming, as I say, that they had been in touch about this. But all we have seen now is that the shop is closed. We don't know where the owner is, and the poster is gone.
Our London correspondent, Dan Whitehead. And that's the Thursday edition of FSN Reports. You can tell us what you think of the show by emailing us, reports@featurestory.com, and you can follow us on Twitter. We're there, @featurestory. Coming up on Friday, we'll be looking at the challenges facing President Obama as he heads to Asia to reinforce US ties on the continent. That's Friday, but for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside producer Simon Marks and Rebecca Foster on the Bulletin Desk. For everyone with Feature Story news everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.